Welcome to Sanity, a podcast by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I try to make sense out of the nonsense and deliver some sanity to your week.
We start every show with a quote about sanity, and this one comes from a show called Better Call Saul. Ever seen that? Jimmy McGill says, "Sometimes you have to say something out loud to hear how crazy it sounds," which I think is going to lead us pretty well into our first segment about Democrats in disarray and Chuck Schumer. But first, let me lay out what we are talking about today on the show. Our top story is Democrats in disarray, what's happening throughout the Democratic Party, and Chuck Schumer's bad week, let's say.
No good, very bad.
No, yeah, right. Make It Make Sense will be about the Trump administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act to expel, to deport Trend-Aragua gang members from the country and the debate that's ensued. Our turning point is going to be about MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, and RFK Jr.'s Secretary Kennedy's changes at HHS, which will affect food and baby food in particular in the country. Very important topic. And then we'll have our sunburns. And I just want to remind everybody that on Sunday, you should look for the Sanity interview, which will be with Mike Duran, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And we're going to be talking Gaza, Iran, Syria, the Houthis, that
Turkey.
Entire region, Turkey, very important.
No shortage of crisis.
Mike is the person to talk to on all of that. So keep an eye out for that on Sunday. Okay, Ari, top story is Democrats in disarray. That's a very exciting topic. Why don't you start us off?
Sure. And I think this felt like the week where the Democratic Party finally sort of emerged from its licking its wounds, kind of being off stage, and is starting to kind of straggle back into the public view, onto the main stage. And, you know, some of its kind of cast of characters are now reasserting themselves. So just as a quick rundown, we have the launch of Gavin Newsom's podcast, not to advertise a competitor, but
I don't think we have to worry.
No, but he's had Steve Bannon on and Tim Walz and has made headlines, I think mostly by having Bannon on, and people are sort of reading the tea leaves about sort of what's that all about. Needless to say, the Times was sort of outraged that Newsom would even talk to Bannon.
And Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk, right? Yeah. We have old Tim Walz kind of, you know, saying that he thinks that Republicans are afraid of him. I'm not quite sure about that.
You're not quite sure?
I'm still a Josh Shapiro truther. So I think Kamala lost the election when she went with Coach Walz. And then right here in New York, the Cuomo train keeps on keeping on. And there's already talk that Cuomo is thinking of Gracie Manchin as a launch pad to the White House. And some also scuttlebutt about Rahm Emanuel, fresh back from eating sushi and sashimi in Tokyo, as our ambassador to Japan, feeding the flames as a potential presidential candidate. So I think if we zoom out, we see kind of, let's say, the moderates, so-called moderates, reassembling, sort of now saying, okay, we get that we have to change, we need to course correct. But whether it's convincing, not quite sure, and whether any of these people feel like the sort of anointed one is up in the air. I will say it seems to me that Democrats have to start the hard work of reinventing themselves and reinventing their party. And the sooner they do that, I think the better chance they'll have of getting back into power.
Yeah, I think that word reinventing is the key for me and the key to why a lot of people are suspect of Gavin Newsom's newfound moderate posture. I think in an era of Donald Trump, where love him or hate him, the authenticity of him is what seems to speak to people. This idea that you could be, you know, against or for men in women's sports one day and then against it the next, in an attempt to kind of reform yourself or recreate yourself or reinvent yourself, is less compelling for people, even those who want to see moderate Democrats reemerge. I think it would be more interesting and and maybe sustainable to find a Democrat who actually is a moderate and to try and elevate that person rather than try and repurpose these people who clearly aren't moderates. Nobody would look at the state of California and pretend that Gavin Newsom is anything but of the left, of the far left. And a lot of the others, some of the others that you mentioned, if they weren't of the far left, they certainly cowed to the far left and sort of by definition became of them. So I think, you know, the Democratic Party in general needs like a reformation. They haven't gone through it and they seem to be refusing to go through it. And I think some of it might have to do with the midterms. Maybe they're just waiting to see, right? Often the president who's in office loses the midterms. And they're hoping that if that happens, then they don't have to completely reform. If it does, if it doesn't happen and the Republicans hold, maybe the real moderates, if there are any left out there, will come to the fore.
Yeah, I think that's a really perceptive read of the landscape. One thing I've been thinking about this week is some data is now coming in to us about the results of the last of the presidential election. And, you know, it shows really not only a shocking gender divide among young people, but just a shocking results among young people, and that is they have swung hard conservative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with COVID and coming of age during COVID. There are other factors that we could brainstorm. But I agree with you that what's needed is a gut renovation rather than a sort of cosmetic facial. And, you know, I think there's an age question here too. I mean, Chuck Schumer has been in the news this week. He has a new book about anti-Semitism. He canceled his tour, his book tour. We know how much politicians love book tours, and he canceled it, not apparently about the anti-Semitism bit, but because Democrats on the left are so angry at him for voting to keep the government open. Mm-hmm. And so that may be gives you a sense of where the energies are right now in the party. One thing that strikes me is even as we have the emergence of these so-called moderates or refashioned moderates, is there's also energy on the left. People are talking about, you know, will AOC challenge Schumer in 2027? And Bernie Sanders is drawing tens of thousands of people throughout the Midwest. That's perhaps not striking given sort of some of the, you know, angst over Elon Musk or whatever. So things are starting to happen on the Democratic side of the aisle. And I totally agree with you that the midterms is the next thing to look forward to.
Yeah, I just want to say, just to veer slightly off topic, but you mentioned Senator Schumer's book on anti-Semitism. I'm so glad he's not doing a tour because I don't want to read it or read about it. The self-professed Shomer Israel, the mm-hmm. guardian of Israel, Schumer, hasn't been one for a very long time now. He may pretend to be, but he hasn't been. And I don't think he has anything that I need to know about the fight against anti-Semitism that would be helpful. This is a man who, you know, I remember his being on his knees during the BLM protests and who fought hard for the DEI identity politics sort of ideology that has done more damage to American Jews, let's say, and their safety and security and Israel's than almost anything else save Islamism. So no thanks to that book and that tour.
Yeah, haven't read it yet. But I will say, you know,
Haven't read it either, and I'm willing to go on record and say I hate it already.
I will say that, you know, Chuck Schumer is a graduate of Harvard, and obviously Columbia is in his district, and as much as it's in New York State, and he, you know, hasn't really proven to be a defender of Jewish students at both those schools during the past year and a half of upheaval there. I go back to this, and maybe it's beating a dead horse that, you know, there was a moment when Biden, after the Biden debate, I think, where some of these folks could have distinguished themselves. And Newsom did not. Mm-hmm. I mean, Newsom, you know, simply did not, backed Biden staying in. And then when that couldn't happen, backed Kamala. And I just think that failure to distinguish themselves at a moment when there was a really difficult call to be made, not only for the country, but about their own party, there still hasn't been a real reckoning.
Right. At least I hate to defend Newsom, but the only thing I think he's getting right is that he's understood that all the infrastructure that the Democrats need to put forward their next candidate is sort of being taken apart piece by piece by Trump and the Republicans, right? They're losing their media dominance. Voice of America was just dismantled and mm-hmm. accused of being far left and mm-hmm. promoting those kinds of values around the globe. And obviously, the mainstream media has taken a hit. The USAID grants that were being used for purposes that often helped Democrat causes, the sort of whole Mike Benz world of NGO funding, all of it, all that infrastructure that propped up the far left, it has been dismantled or is being dismantled or is being severely challenged. And so they have to rebuild not just a candidate, but a platform for that candidate. I don't think that Gavin Newsom is the person to do it, but at least he has seen that they're not in the podcast world in a meaningful, serious way that isn't yeah. highly partisan. And he's trying to rebuild some of that infrastructure.
Yeah. I'm impressed, impressed with a lowercase I, not an uppercase I, that he would have Steve Bannon on. I mean, maybe that seems like a low bar, but I think, you know, that to even dialogue with folks on the very, very different side of the aisle, and he's taken a lot of heat for it. And so we'll see where that goes. You know, we'll see if this is the start maybe of a more, as you mentioned, kind of less siloed or polarized media environment on the left. I do think there will be opportunities for Democrats. I mean, 2, 3, 4 years is an eternity in politics, and who knows what can happen. So, you know, I mean, the days of parties being in the wilderness for a long time, maybe we'll see that. Or maybe Trump, you know, will provide opportunities, as every president does, to reemerge. I mean, I remember when Kerry lost in 2004, and there was a sense of, you know, total Democratic despair, right? How could Bush win again? I mean, let alone the first time, and you had the Iraq War and all this stuff. And within 3 years, you had, you know, a law professor with the middle name Hussein yeah. who swept the country. So a lot can happen.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to Make It Make Sense. The Trump administration invoked the 1798 mm-hmm. Alien Enemies Act to deport a few plane loads of Trandaragua gang members. El Salvador took them into their infamous prison, and a district judge tried to get the planes to turn around, and, you know, all hell broke loose on the left. And it ignited this debate about this law in particular, and about more generally, more broadly, what are the limits of the executive power to remove people from the country, to remove illegals from the country as distinguished from citizens or even visa holders, as we talked about last week.
Sure.
So there are a lot of legal questions that I think would be really useful to dig into. I just want to step back, though, before you do that, and just point out something that I think is obvious, but is worth pointing out. We didn't have a Trandaragua problem in this country four and a half years ago. Our borders have been wide open. During the prior administration, people came here who shouldn't be here, including very violent and horrible people. Nothing was done to stop them from coming. That has been proven now to be true, if you didn't already know it, by the stats at the border that ICE is releasing, right? The arrests at the border, I think in the first 50 days, were something like 32,000. And the numbers of I think 75% of them had criminal records. And the numbers of actual people getting into the country is, you know, sort of de minimis at this point. So it wasn't that hard to stop mm-hmm. Trandaragua from even getting here. And nobody did anything to stop it. And that was a deliberate choice.
Yeah, I still think Trump's best line in these first 60-something days of administration has been, you didn't need new laws, you needed a new president. And the only issue right now on which Trump is above water approval-wise is on immigration.
Yes. Yes. And
that's important because that's also his core issue. So it's right. There's a sign of that is resonating with Americans, even as there's skepticism about tariffs and the court stuff and everything
right.
else.
So I think that's important to note, and important because of the politics of it. Wherever we stand on the legal details about mm-hmm. this act and whether or not it was properly used, the truth is that the Democrats are now a party who are advocating, the ACLU is advocating, a judge in D.C. is advocating for the return of Trandaragua to America. Mm-hmm. They may have a legal point,
right.
but the political optics on it are terrible, and that's the trap that Trump set for them and that they fell into. And okay, so here we are. So I think the legal questions matter. As I looked at the act, and there's been a lot of discussion about whether this can only be invoked during wartime. Mm-hmm. Stephen Miller was on TV saying, no, it also has to do with, what's the right word, an incursion or
invasion.
And the president gets to designate that. Can you just give us briefly the legal, your legal perspective on whether or not this act was properly invoked?
Sure. And there are two issues here. One is the act legally invoked? And two is this debate about did the administration listen to the judge when he ordered the train, the planes turned around, almost a scene out of like a James Bond movie or something.
Yeah.
You know, the planes are in the air and you're getting the phone call. You know, we at The Sun did some digging on this, and we have an editorial on this. And, you know, what we found sort of surprised us, and that is that the act, although it has only been invoked three times, all sort of in a war context, does give the president real latitude over the ability to proclaim or declare an invasion, and then to take action against it.
What does that declaration look like? Does he just say it? Does he have to write
it down? So this is unclear. I mean, Trump did say it. I mean, I think it was a televised, but specifically, and I think it was memorialized in a kind of declaration. But and Justice Felix Frankfurter is the source on this. And now the devil will be in the details. How was it invoked? How was it applied? All that. But it's not a crazy idea. I think where there's been sort of a lot of attention has been this process, right, of kind of does a district court judge have jurisdiction over activities that are related to or even integral to national security and national defense, which a president is obviously tasked
with. What I think is so interesting about that question is that it's a question. I think so many of us would have thought that this would have been a resolved question under the law by 2025. That it isn't is already interesting to me.
Right. And you know, the question here been, you know, these people were in Texas. They were then sent via plane to El Salvador, where we have a deal to accept prisoners in exchange for a pretty nominal fee. The president of El Salvador said, it's not a lot of money for you, but it's a lot of money for us. It felt like, you know, you go on vacation.
But compared to what we would have to spend on all the legal costs on the housing and all those things of those people over time, actually, it is a bargain for us.
Of course, yeah. I mean, you know, the sort of crux of this law is that you don't have to provide people with any due process. And we're seeing an effort by the administration to sort of move immigration from a legal question to a national security question. And we're seeing that in real time. And this is the new sort of line that this is a national security. And the implication of that would be enormous. One, it would limit the ability of judges to review these decisions. Just as a judge generally wouldn't be able to review, you know, a military maneuver, right, or a decision in military court, a military field of battle, theater. And the other is that it would expedite these processes. I think in a larger sense, one of the things Trump is doing is sort of reimagining the relationship of America with non-citizens who are here. And we see that with the Venezuelans. We see that with Mahmoud Khalil, a green card holder. And we see that with the effort to overturn birthright citizenship.
Just before we get into the theoretical, like just actually nuts and bolts, just so everyone understands, if you are here illegally and Tom Homan catches you, there's a immigration court that you have to have some kind of sign off before you're deported. And the difference here is that the Trump
administration, process at all.
There is no process at all.
Right.
Okay. So then, and then the to sort of to steel man the argument on that side, you would say, well, how do you know then that a president is deporting real Trendaragua, you know, members? Who's making sure that we have the right people? Isn't that
this is a concern? This is a real concern. I mean, the administration hasn't released the names. They refuse to release it. We saw, especially if you're a civil libertarian of any stripe, of the right or the left, I think you have to be a little bit concerned. I mean, just as the Patriot Act swept up a lot of folks, and you know, who were sort of whose status was unclear. It's not crazy to think similar things could happen here. And the idea that someone can be whisked away to another country with no sort of process, I think does give people pause. Right.
Now, was the legal argument that the Trump administration was making that the planes were already outside of American airspace, is that a valid legal argument?
Yeah. So basically, you know, you have to look at the TikTok here. And at about 6:45 p.m. on Saturday night, the judge said these planes can't leave, or if they're in the air, they need to stop. That was orally delivered in court. Now, that oral command was memorialized at 7:25 p.m. in a written order. The Trump administration is saying that that crucial 45-minute difference, that's when the planes sort of left
but
and
not
landed.
The third plane, which was still on the ground, but then they argued that the people on that plane right. were of a different status.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think listen, this is getting really close to, you know, it's almost like a parent tells a kid to do something and it says, this is getting really close to just flat out not listening.
Right.
Now, they might argue that, you know, that's the right decision, but, you know, you had Chief Roberts weigh in and say, wait a second, like this is getting pretty serious. So it'll be interesting to see how the administration negotiates that. I mean, they're still walking that line. They're still saying we didn't defy an order. It was an oral order. It wasn't a written one. There was this ambiguity. But it's really getting close to that line.
But so, you know, what's interesting also about this is that whenever we talk about these issues that bump up against constitutional crises, which I don't think we're in, but people have thrown that that phrase about, it's the focus is always on the president and his, you know, not responding to the order of a court. What about the argument that courts are instigating constitutional crises by potentially issuing orders they had no right to issue in the first place, in which case, why should the president have to listen to it? And isn't Judge Boasberg creating the constitutional crisis here, not the president? Is that a valid argument?
Right. And this is another thing we're starting to hear from the administration is against this notion of a single judge making an injunction for the whole country or a single judge overstepping their authority. Now, what John Roberts would tell you is, of course, that could happen, but that's what appeals are for. And I think it is likely that a lot of these decisions would be overturned on appeal. The question is to not, you know, this isn't about appeal. This is about at the point of decision, contesting it.
Yeah.
And you know, that's inevitably gonna generate a lot more friction.
Right. So just to wrap this segment up, just there are a few solutions that were thrown on the table by different people. Ron DeSantis sort of suggested that we strip these courts of their jurisdictions, which would require 60 votes in Congress to do, which wouldn't likely happen. And then he said, well, attach it to a must spend bill and force the issue. Chip Roy of Texas said we should actually pass a House resolution declaring an invasion, which would allow this act to be undisputedly within the purview of the executive. Do you favor either of those? Do you think this just has to go up to SCOTUS? And SCOTUS seems to want it, but didn't John Roberts now just step in it? Should he have made that decision now, knowing that this might well come before the court, and now he's seen as having already.
So to be fair to the chief, his statement was in reference to efforts to impeach judges rather than this specific decision.
Fair enough.
I think Roberts, you know, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is both the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but also the head of the whole federal judiciary. So he's hearing from federal judges, right, that they're under attack. Mm-hmm. So think of him almost as like the president of the judiciary. So he has his own constituency, right? And his own
interests.
Does
he ever turn to them and say, cut this out? You know, you're filing all of these injunctions and things and they're out of your... There was one... Well, it's a separate matter, but there was a judge, Theodore Chang, who ruled that access has to be returned to USAID, and his reasoning was because USAID was established by Congress, which it was not. Mm-hmm. So the judge didn't even know the facts of the case on which he was issuing an injunction. So doesn't John Roberts have, Justice Roberts, have a responsibility to also speak in the other direction to these lower courts and say, you know, stop it?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, lower court judges are overturned all the time. So there would be nothing shocking about that this being overturned. But we're seeing just such a high volume of these orders and in such a kinetic kind of environment that it's really putting pressure.
Okay, so what will stop this from being our daily, you know, we open the paper every day and read about another one of these. Will the SCOTUS decision?
I think partially it's a like a metabolism question. I think Trump has moved very quickly. And at some point, these cases will sort of mature through the system, you know. And if the system can handle it, if it can work, then, you know, he'll win some and he'll lose some, mm-hmm. you know. And that's kind of how it works. And we might get an occasional SCOTUS decision on the Alien Enemies Act, on the nature of DOGE, which is the decision you just mm-hmm. and on the president's ability to hire and fire, and on some spending issues, you know, but it takes time. And I don't know if the metabolism of our political system, the cadence of our political system, is well matched for the kind of slow, deliberate judicial system.
Oh. You know? That's depressing news because I'm tired of talking about these things, but I guess what you're saying is we're going to. So, all right, fodder for the future.
Absolutely.
Let's turn now to the turning point mm-hmm. segment. Here we're going to talk about MAHA. This was a major part of the Trump campaign, this MAHA movement, and Secretary Kennedy's taking over of HHS. And I think it's important to point out that he is delivering. And there are a couple of just quick things I think everyone should be aware of if you're not already. The secretary ordered the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to basically get rid of, going forward, something called GRAS, the Generally Recognized as Safe Exemption, which food companies have been using since the 1950s to allow them to put ingredients into their food products that don't have to go through all of these assessments and reviews at the FDA. And that was created back in the 50s because there were very few ingredients in our food. And so you didn't want to have to go and ask about salt and baking soda and all those things every time. It was very inefficient. The problem, as Secretary Kennedy has pointed out, is that there are today over 10,000 different ingredients, chemicals among them, in our foods. And these food companies are allowed to define their own ingredients as generally regarded as safe. So then they are not subject to FDA review. So there are things in our foods that may be toxic, and they are only taken out if they are proven to be so. So it's like after the fact.
So this is just this is now an order.
He ordered the.
And so now we'll have companies having to
this disclose, exemption going or, forward no longer applies. Okay. You can't, as a food company, say this ingredient falls under this exemption. And he's going to be he's already ordered that there would be assessments of the ingredients in our foods. So it's just good common sense review. It's been decades, and a lot of things have changed in the food industry. We want to make sure that the things that we're buying on the shelves in the supermarket actually are food and not 15-syllable chemicals that no one can pronounce and could potentially do harm to all of us. So I hope there's no controversy over this one. There shouldn't be. And similarly, Secretary Kennedy ordered something called the Operation Stork Speed, that the FDA would have to do a nutrient review and testing for heavy metals in baby formula. Again, one would have thought that that would have already been in place, but it's not. And again, he's not suggesting that there's necessarily a direct correlation or causation between what's in these formulas and, I don't know, peanut allergies and the rash of chronic illnesses that are plaguing our children. But he is saying it'd be nice to know what's going into baby formula. And again, it feels very common sense-y and non-controversial. What has become controversial, which I think is shocking, is the SNAP food program. And there, Secretary Kennedy's been talking about pulling sugary foods and sodas out of the SNAP food program so that they're not subsidized by the federal government. They're not good for anybody. So why should the government? You can still buy it if you choose to, but not through federal subsidies. And there have been state by state all of these hearings and shocking debates. And the one that stood out was one just recently in Texas where they were discussing this and pulling sugary foods and sodas out of school lunches, different than the SNAP program, but sort of a related issue. And a member of the American Heart Association, a lobbyist, showed up to fight them on that. And the woman arguing before the adoption of the bill, looked at him and said, you work for the American Heart Association. Why are you fighting for this? So that speaks a lot to the corporate capture and big food lobbying issue that Secretary Kennedy has been very vocal about since he came.
I remember the Mike Bloomberg effort to ban sugary food. It was, right. You know,
he wasn't got that the extra large?
The extra big gulp, big gulp. Yeah. And he got, a lot of criticism as a kind of nanny state and all this stuff. But
Well, that's different, though. Again, there's federal subsidies for things that are bad for you, and then there's banning it. If I want a big gulp, stay out of my lane. But should the government fund me to buy that extra large big gulp? Those are two separate questions, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think we can there's a lot to say about Secretary Kennedy, and I think this is it. Thank you for sort of spotlighting some of these initiatives. I think what's indisputable is that, as you said, that his coalition and his contribution to Trump's coalition were major factors in the election.
Very important. People wanted this, and he's delivering.
Yeah. There was some controversy over this $1 billion for school lunches. I think there's sort of more to sort out there, but I know we'll have listeners who, and maybe Milovic says, well, what about the vaccines and the measles issues and the bird flu? And there's all that. But I think this has been really helpful to say that, health in America is a really broad question.
Right.
And fostering better habits is a kind of, we talked about, is immigration a national security issue? Mm-hmm. Well, in some ways, mm-hmm. health is a national security issue.
Of course it is. And look, I think, a lot of libertarians would say everybody's responsible for their own health and nobody's forcing you to go to the supermarket and buy the thing with the poly blah, blah, blah that you can't pronounce. And that is true. But I think it's also fair to say that some of these companies know full well that they're putting things in our foods that are not good for us. And I think it's also fair to say the average person who has a life and has a job and has children and other things to think about, they should be responsible for what they put in their body. But I think the system could, at minimum, provide them with foods on the shelves that aren't
toxic.
Well,
you can only buy what's on the shelf, right? And especially with
we're not all going and starting a garden.
Right, of course. And especially with the price of food nowadays. Yeah. I mean, people are really under crunch in terms of, and are maybe gravitating towards buying things that are less expensive.
Right.
And if those things that are less expensive often are less healthy,
yes.
That's a sort of just a vicious loop feedback.
Right. I think we can at least expect our government to not put red dye 40 in our Fruit Loops.
Right. I do love Fruit Loops. A guilty pleasure.
Okay, sunburn time.
Okay, great. I feel like I do this every week, obviously.
Is it Barnard in Columbia?
It's Columbia. Listen,
my goodness.
Listen,
I mean, they deserve it, but
I was just going to say,
obsessed.
Today is a really big day. By the time you listen to this broadcast, something might already happen. It's the peril of the news. It always happens. But Columbia seems like it's on the verge of capitulating to the Trump administration's demands in terms of putting some programs in receivership. Adopting the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and others, I think what was really striking to me is that the thing that really seems to have pushed it over the edge was not a lawsuit from Jewish students, was not a kind of pro-Israel investigation. It was a suit brought by Columbia workers mm-hmm. and maintenance workers and janitors, and simply saying, these folks say, we have seen a level of anti-Semitism here that is just beyond. And it suggests that what happened at Columbia was not actually representative of what was happening at other schools, but was uniquely bad. Mm-hmm. Swastikas, invective against Jews, just really sort of unvarnished anti-Semitism. And I think the big question for Columbia is, they don't like the government breathing down their neck. And I get that. But why did things get this bad? What are the disciplinary practices that allow things get this bad? But more interestingly, what are the intellectual habits? What are the sort of social dynamics that allowed a situation like this to spiral out of control? And the easy thing now is to lash out against Washington. The much harder thing is to say, how do we fix this? And how do we fix this campus? Or is it too late?
Right. Well, I guess I shouldn't tease you because I was almost going to do for my son Bern University of Pennsylvania, which is my alma mater, which deserves an equal sort of ripping and shredding. And maybe I'll just write about it because I can't even speak about it. It makes me so angry. So I understand why you keep going back there. They really do deserve it. My son Bern has to do with a small bill in Illinois, but I think it has larger impact. It's Illinois Bill HB 2827. It's designed to increase regulations on homeschooling families and their parents and the children. I'm not going to get into the educational sort of validity of these regulations. I could see an argument that there should be regulations, and I also see the argument that these regulations go way too far and are written in such broad terms that they invite future abuses and overreach and state control that I think is actually quite dangerous. And the bigger point for me is I think they're designed to be a part of this larger narrative of parents' rights and the denial of parents' rights. The state, as we saw during COVID, during the school board meetings, we see that the state feels, or some parts of the state have felt, that it's their responsibility to raise children, and they are finding themselves increasingly pushing back against parents who, and for thousands of years, have always thought it was their responsibility to raise their own children. And if you look at the findings in this particular bill, they're very telling. They talk about the states need to protect children from neglect and abuse. There's zero evidence that there is a greater amount of neglect or abuse amongst homeschooled children. They also sort of without shame talk about the need to ensure that children are being educated properly when in the state of Illinois, only one in three 11th graders can read at grade level.
Astonishing.
So if anybody should be dictating to parents how to make sure that their children are readers, I don't think it's the education professionals in the state of Illinois. They have a lot in their own house to fix. So this bill was fought against 41,000 signatures registered in opposition to it, and yet it passed through the Education Policy Committee. It doesn't look stoppable at this point. So it's not going to upend everything about the homeschool system, but this is how it starts, and that's why I think it's important. When we overlook these small encroachments on parental rights, we invite even larger ones. And I really worry that this is going to be a setup for something much broader and much more dangerous in the future.
It's great to spotlight and definitely a story worth following. Just two things, Rebecca, on that. One is encouraging folks to listen to our interview with Naomi Schaefer Riley, not exactly on that point, but on the intersection between the state and child rearing and family.
Right.
And the other is just to say that some of the most interesting, idiosyncratic, smart people I know were homeschooled. And I definitely found that when I was at Harvard, that this sort of ability to think outside the box, a kind of eclecticism of interest. And again, I'm not generalizing for everybody, but the idea that there's only one way to do this is obviously not right.
Right. Well, we know the way not to do it, and the state of Illinois has produced that way. So maybe we should take it easy on parents who want to homeschool.
Okay. Rebecca, thank you so much. And see you next week.
See you next week, Ari. Bye.